The Talk of the Northwest, The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio.
And a very good morning to you. This is The Greg Hughes Show on Highland Radio. It's Donal Kavanagh standing in for Greg on the show this morning. We have a lot to get through over the next 2 hours, but as always, it's your views, your perspectives, and your take on the issues of the day that is at the very heart of this programme. You can text or WhatsApp us on 086 60 25000. Call us on 0749 125000, 0035 374 91 25000 if you're outside of the dialing area. We're also available electronically. Comments at highlandradio.com. You can get us via social media. We're at Highland Radio on X. We're Highland Hub on Facebook. You can watch the show unfold live on our Facebook channels and also on our YouTube channel, Highland Radio Ireland. And as well as all that, you can use other social media platforms as well. Whatever way you interact, please do interact and let us know your thoughts on the issues of the day. We're going to be having a discussion a little later on the best location for a bus depot in Letterkenny. A lot of discussion about that this week, and we'll get to that in due course. But we're going to start with a look at the papers and the Finn Valley Voice out this morning. And the front page story by Pat Holland is highlighting the fact that a Ballybofey woman is at the heart of the publication of the census figures from 1926. Orla McBride, a Ballybofey-born woman, is presenting the story of us. It's the National Archives began work on this a year ago, led by Orla McBride. It was, in her words, an opportunity to honour those who came before us for their resilience, their ambition and their contribution to the Ireland that we know today. And there's an interesting take on this, because Pat writes the story in terms of an analysis of the drop-off in the number of Protestants who were living in the East Donegal area over the period between 1911, the census details from 1911 were published a couple of years ago, and now we've got 1926. Now, obviously, the difference geopolitically between 1911 and 1926 is huge. 1911, you had the Home Rule movement, Ireland was part of the United Kingdom, and we were pre-World War I. 1926, we've had the First World War, the War of Independence, the Civil War, we've had the treaty, and 1926 was the year of the Boundary Commission. So the leap in the geopolitical structures of the Free State, Ireland era, call it what you will, it's huge. And there's an interesting analysis of what that meant for the religious makeup of populations in East Donegal, and how there was obviously migration of Protestants away from the area, and that process had started even before 1926. It is a very interesting article indeed. The Irish Independent main story is all about the prospect of income tax reductions because of the budget surplus. There is a lot of analysis of the public finances within the Irish Independent, and indeed the other broadsheet papers as well. There's one story: public finances are in rude health, but there's a warning that spending is still excessive, and there's always going to be a clashing priority, because on the one hand, if the public figures are good and we have a supposed surplus, now don't forget we do have a national debt, by the way, lurking in the background, so it isn't as though we have 9 billion extra euro that we can just do whatever we want with. We still have a debt to service, we still have an awful lot to do in terms of the economy, and you'll still have the Department of Public Expenditure pushing to save as much money as possible, and every other department pushing to maximise the spending and maximise its own take from that surplus. But on the one hand, you have there should be income tax reductions that will be pushed, I'm sure, a lot by Fine Gael. There'll be pushes for greater spending. There'll also, of course, be pushes from people like the Fiscal Advisory Body and others warning us, look, we can't be losing the run of ourselves. Let's hold back and spend less and save more and put more money into the Rainy Day Fund. And there'll be all these competing perspectives, as there always are. There's an interesting story too in there. Charlie Weston writes, and I find Charlie Weston a really interesting author when it comes to money matters and finance matters. He has his finger on the pulse, I think, both in terms of the wider economy and in terms of the thinkings of ordinary citizens as well. But home energy upgrade applications double amid crisis, and we know there's been a big debate in Donegal with regards to retrofitting and how it's being handled by Donegal County Council and in the context of social housing. But there is also a huge focus on retrofitting and making homes more energy efficient in the wider housing scope as well. Charlie Weston writes, applications for grants for home energy upgrades have nearly doubled since last year. Amid the energy crisis created by the war in the Middle East, 29,000 applications from homeowners have been processed in the first 3 months of this year. Energy Minister Dara O'Brien said this is an increase of 96% on the same period in 2025. And that is a huge increase indeed. It's an interesting story on the inside of the Irish Times, and you may have heard on the news last evening, Deputy Patrick McLaughlin raising in the Dáil yesterday the comments of Leo Varadkar that effectively Dublin and urban Ireland were paying for rural Ireland. And Arthur Beasley has an article, and the headline is a quote: "I'd like to see Leo milk 120 cows twice a day. Was Varadkar wrong about rural Ireland?" It's an interesting question. Irish Farmers Association President Francie Gorman, Minister Martin Hayden quoted in there as well. And quite a lot of talk about that comment, and whether Leo meant it as a throwaway comment or Leo meant to start a debate. Whatever he meant, he has certainly walked himself right into a debate and started an interesting one. That Patrick McLaughlin in the Dáil yesterday characterised it as, in a sense, the true colours of Fine Gael being laid bare for all to see. He said the mask had slipped and we now see the truth. This is the way we're regarded. Also in the Times, again, larger €9 billion surplus adds to pressure on government for spending increases. Interesting analysis as well by Miriam Lord. Two-for-one deal comes back to bite the Healy Rays. Danny Healy Ray yesterday lost his place on the Oireachtas Agriculture Committee, and he appealed to be allowed to keep his place on the committee, saying he believed he was there in his own right and not as a government representative, but I'm not sure that is the way it works. We spoke of public spending in the Irish Daily Mail this morning. Ministers angry at having to pay levy for departments' serial overspending. You all have to shoulder the burden of bailouts in education. A row erupted in Cabinet after ministers were told they'd have to cover the overspending in the Education Department. It was reported last month that the Department of Education required bailouts totalling more than €4 billion over the past 3 years. And now Jack Chambers, the Public Expenditure Minister, has told Cabinet that basically every ministry will have to get a little bit less in order to make up for the situation in education. Also on the inside of the Mail, a very quick one, the North's First Minister has welcomed a judge's dismissal yesterday of a legal challenge against Belfast City Council's draft Irish language policy. The case against the proposal was taken by traditional unionist voice member Anne McClure, who argued the council hadn't followed guidelines on protecting minority communities. Irish Daily Mirror this morning: we'll rain on your blockades. The Gartha Commissioner Justin Kelly has set up a special team to hunt down anyone who broke the law during the fuel blockades, which caused chaos 2 weeks ago. He also revealed the incident rooms are targeting people who harassed Gardaí and other emergency services during the crisis, whether online or in person. And there's more on that on the inside of the Irish Daily Mirror. Irish Sun, Christy, you're next. Again, Justin Kelly is being quoted. He vows to nail the rest of the Kinahan cartel's leaders as part of a wider drugs and murder probe. That's the front of the Sun. That also highlighted in the Star as well. One down, two to go. We're not done yet. We have got one. Daniel Kinahan has been arrested, but his father, Christy Kinahan, and his brother, Christopher Kinahan, are still, we're told, in the Gartha's targets. Also on the front of the Irish Daily Star, Gartha in Bikegate scandal is hailed. The Gartha at the centre of the Bikegate controversy was yesterday given a warm welcome at a Gartha conference. And I must confess, I had followed this story in the Sunday Independent, and it first emerged in the Sunday Independent, I'd say, 3 years ago. This story first emerged in the Sunday Independent, and I was following this over the intervening period because I just found this the craziest story I'd heard in a long time. The one where a detective Gartha, who is now named and pictured, he's Eamon Canaan, he was suspended for years, subjected to a criminal investigation because he lent a bike to a neighbour. During COVID, the bike had been stored at the local Gartha station. The GRA heard his treatment was a shameful stain on the organisation. Yesterday there was a meeting of the local community safety partnership in Donegal, and one of the issues raised was the lack of a drug dog, Gartha dog and Gartha unit in Donegal that looks after dogs. It's been 3 years since a dog was designated to the Donegal region, and there was a dog in training nationally to be allocated to a Gartha division, but that dog didn't, we understand, get through the training. Joined by Councillor Michael McClafferty, who raised that issue at the DCSP meeting yesterday. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Donal. Good morning, listeners.
Michael, in terms of the lack of a dog in Donegal, I mean, how important is this that there should be a dog deployed in Donegal for use by Gardaí?
Well, Donal, I think it's vital. A dog would be deployed to Donegal and basically stationed in Donegal with all, everything that's going on at the moment here. It has been for many years, like in the fight against crime, the fight against drugs, so on, etc. I think it's well due and well high past time now, Donal, since we would have our own dedicated drug dog here in Donegal, / sniffer dog, so on, etc. And I don't think we're asking the impossible here for that, Donal, to be quite honest about it. I just think we're only asking what our community needs, what our town, what our county needs, or our bordering counties either. Obviously, the dog could be shared out. Donegal, Cavan, Monaghan, etc., or bordering counties, if you like, as such. There's no reason why that couldn't be equally shared out among ourselves. But the reality is here at the minute now, we don't have a dog. And as, like I say, it's 3 years coming down June, Donal, since the last time a dog was talked about at the forum, the JPC meeting at that time. Then obviously the local elections come along, and for whatever reason, then one reason or another, there seemed to be a delay then, a short pause as such, and getting a meeting formalised again then with the JPC and so on going forward. And here we are today now again. As I said, like, I got correspondence there the last day from Gardaí Síochána, which I'm grateful for, but the letter just stated basically that a dog wasn't training. The dog didn't make the assessment at the final stage, which I understand is make or break on their final day of assessment. That dog didn't pass the test, and now currently another dog has apparently been sought now for training again now going forward. But like I said yesterday too, Donald, to be fair, If this is the model that we have currently going forward, training one dog at a time, while we appreciate that it takes a lot of time and effort and everything else for the handler or handlers involved, or the trainer or trainers involved, I'm not exactly sure of the background how they do it, but regardless, one dog at a time is going to take a long time to serve all our counties and communities' needs as such.
And just to clarify, this isn't a dog being trained for deployment in Donegal. This is a dog being trained nationally for deployment somewhere in the country. There is nationally one dog in training at the moment.
That's my understanding, Donal. Nationally one dog in training, as you say, and wherever that dog ends up then, he or she ends up then, the dog, obviously. But my opinion is here, like I was saying yesterday at the meeting, there should be multiple dogs at any one point in training. Now, I know they're going to argue it comes down to resources and one thing or another. That may be the case, but my argument is there. Put the money into the resources. This is what's wrong with the county, with the country at the minute. The various relevant resources get starved of money across all various bodies, and then we end up in a situation then where we're struggling then, or we're past struggling. Some people are just morale's on the floor, to be fair, and different agencies. Like we heard as well that yesterday, like from the supers touched on there yesterday, not just themselves in Gardaí Síochána, but across all state agencies, they all can do with more staff, more recruitment, so on. And that seems to be the problem here. We are not putting the emphasis on the efforts at an early stage, so on our recruitment, let it be staff, let it be, on this occasion now, looking to get dogs trained, get a dog unit here. And I just feel going forward, the horse is going to be bolted on many occasions, and we're missing opportunity all the time. And at this stage of the day, Donal, to be fair, God knows when we're going to actually get our own dedicated dog for Donegal, or to say, / Leitrim, Cavan, Monaghan, the border counties in the northwest here.
And in terms of the need for a dog, I mean, we know that it's just a number of days since we got news of a fairly substantial drug seizure not all that far away from you in Dunfanaghy.
Yeah, that's right. In the Dunfanaghy area, it's unfortunately that's the reality. It's out there. It's on the news. There's no getting away from that. Like Dunfanaghy's no different than any other community. These things can start to creep in and onto us all, and before you know it, then you have a problem. Obviously, it's very unwelcome news, but it has happened. Like I said to yourself there yesterday, we had the couple of young ladies there from Loretta College there on the youth council there. You know, when they were pitching their points going forward there. And like I said, the young people of today, Donal, as we all know, like, they're our ambassadors for the future going forward. And if we can't, as adults, can't stand up and assist our young people and help them going forward and guide them going forward and try and teach them what's right and what's wrong and so on, going forward, we're going to be in a serious situation in 40 years' time. let alone today. So as situations like that, we all have a part to play, each and every one of us. And as I say at the moment now, I believe getting a drug dog here to Donegal would be a huge asset to a Garda Síochána corner, alongside the great work to do. The Yards here do a great work, to be fair, like, and far beyond the call of duty in many times. And to be worthwhile, Donal pointing out as well, it's not just all going out about doing their basic jobs that they're supposed to be doing. They're dealing with other situations we learned yesterday in the chamber about as well, mental health situations and so on, difficult situations, domestic situations. I know that's part of their thing, but to be fair, when they're tied up on that kind of stuff and the HSE then don't have the facilities then alongside to deal with those situations, we heard yesterday about the figure was mentioned about 44 people detained and so on, and many of them then released then again. It's those 44 people need the care, they need the help, they need the resources, whatever they needed at that moment in time, as the Yards put it there. And that's what we need to be looking at going forward. And particularly when we had the Youth Council on there yesterday, Donal, as a collective, I think we all done our best on it. We tried to let them see as well. We all put our best foot forward yesterday on that. And that's where we need to be. And that's where I want to be in this county, as one of 37 county councillors. We all have a part to play. Councillor, Garda Síochána, fire officer, HSE, whatever it may be, liaison officers alone. That's what's touched on yesterday too as an agency. We all have a part to play here in our county because we all love our county, we want our county to prosper and be one of the best counties going. But we're only going to manage that and achieve that only if we all look out for each other.
Well, we know that the Community Safety Partnership now at your behest is going to write to the Garda Commissioner, Justin Kelly, to point out the need both for a dog specifically, but also the need for more resources, as you outlined there. So it's going to get back to the Commissioner and we'll see what happens from there. In the meantime, Councillor Michael McLafferty, thank you very much indeed for joining us this morning and for outlining that issue. It's an interesting one and we will keep a very close eye on it. But for the moment, Michael, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much, Joel. Much appreciated.
And that's Councillor Michael McLafferty there. That issue raised, as we said before, the meeting of the Donegal Community Safety Partnership, which took place yesterday. A few of your comments. There was a call yesterday suggesting that the Donegal Down games had to be played on Sunday, the first championship game in O'Donnell Park in over 70 years, that it should be played in Ballyshannon rather than Letterkenny. Another caller says, look, I definitely agree this game should be played in Ballyshannon. O'Donnell Park is a bad place to get in and out of. The views of the pitch are terrible unless you're in the main stand. Now, there is a contrary argument that says last time I attended a game in Ballyshannon, I had to park on the Donegal Town Road. There is no large parking spaces like in Letterkenny in Ballyshannon and no proper stand. That caller needs to get a grip. Now, with regards to parking, there is a very comprehensive parking plan in place for that match. Now, if you want to get the full details on that, you can go into our website, highlandradio.com. There's an area there called Playback. And if you go into Playback, you can listen back to the Community Garda slot that happened on the show yesterday. And in the course of that, Sergeant Eunan Walsh outlined a very comprehensive traffic management plan. There will be road closures in effect and there's a very comprehensive car parking plan in place. And you can get that car parking plan, as I said, on our website on the Playback section there. Listen back to the Community Garda information slot. With regards to dogs, a caller says, can farmers shoot untagged sheep that are trespassing? I don't quite get that, to be bluntly honest with you. Letterkenny Emergency Department had 1,143 people attending and 345 admitted to an inpatient bed over the course of the past week. And the caller says, it makes me wonder how many of the remaining 800 people, apart from bone breaks, really didn't need to be there and could have been treated by a GP. An interesting question indeed. Now, we listened a little earlier to Councillor Michael McLafferty with regards to the need for more Garda resources. I'm joined on the line by Superintendent Siobhan Mullaghan, who has responsibility for the Donegal North Community Engagement Functional Area within the Donegal Garda Division. And the Superintendent presented a report to the Community Safety Partnership yesterday. Superintendent, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Donal. Good morning to you and your listeners.
Super, the figures, and we will state this from the off because I know these are initial indicative figures which haven't maybe been fully processed, haven't yet been gone through the collation, etc. by the CSO. So these are very raw figures as such that you presented to the the partnership yesterday. In a number of areas, crime is going down. In a number of areas, it's rising. And concern expressed about a number of the figures you presented as well. Where do things stand at the moment with regards to crime in the North Donegal area and Donegal in particular?
Yeah, look, Donegal, I suppose, has steady issues with crime. You know, in general, our burglary non-residentials are down slightly over the course. What we measured for the local community safety partnership is from, we'll say, the end of, up to the end of March, so the first quarter. And so they would have been down slightly, and same with residential burglaries as well. And thefts are up slightly as well. Like, so certain offences, you know, they move up and down. There's no huge increases or decreases. So I suppose an increase in detections for drugs for sale and supply, they were up over the course of the year from 72 to 85 incidents. I suppose that is significant. And also our serious injury road traffic collisions are down from 62 to 47 in the space of that year.
One of the figures that elicited some comment from the members of the partnership was a figure suggesting 44 mental health detentions or interventions over the course of that period. And that figure, it did seem quite high.
Yeah. And actually, that's just for Donegal North. For the year for Donegal as a county, you were talking about 50 mental health interventions, including detentions. So it is high, and it is a steady issue for us, definitely, dealing with mental health issues on the ground and having to resort to using our powers under the Mental Health Act to detain people and ask a clinician really to review them for acceptance into an approved centre. So yeah, that is a steady issue for us on the ground.
The number of domestic incidents reported also seemed quite high, and that they had fallen, but from the top of my head, my recollection is they'd fallen from about 1,500 down to 1,400, and that still is a very high figure, it seems.
Yeah, it is a high figure, and again, we would go to a number of domestic-related incidents on a daily basis all across the county. And nationally, we know that in 2025, there were over 67,000 calls for service in relation to domestic abuse incidents. And over the course of that year, including all domestic-related matters, we had 1,474 calls. So that is down minus 2.7% on the year previous, Donal. So at least it is going in the right direction, but it's still high number. And again, that reflects on a daily basis the type of calls that we are going to, where people really are in dire straits and looking for assistance from ourselves.
Inevitably, the issue of resources is going to get discussed at a meeting. And indeed, we heard from Councillor McLaverty just before about the issues that he raised. Now, I'm obviously not going to ask you to comment directly on such things, but I suppose as a superintendent working in the North Donegal area, you could always do with more.
Absolutely, Donal. We'd love to get more. And I mean, we are hoping with increased recruitment into the Guards over the last few years since COVID, we're hoping to increase the numbers of probationers that are allocated to Donegal. And I will be hopeful in the coming weeks that we will see an increase in probationers coming. And it's great to get new blood, you know, new members, newly trained, fresh on the ground coming into the division. And we'd be hopeful of getting some in the next few weeks. But certainly, it is a constant issue, and we have specialisation, you know, into crime and different units as well, and that has an impact on the front line. And I suppose I'm looking at my front line personnel, trying to bolster them all the time. But I think the thing about the local community safety partnership is that it goes far beyond traditional policing response, and the partnership requires all, I suppose, state bodies and voluntary organisations to work together in a joined up way. And you know, this new partnership approach is introduced to try and encourage greater community participation and empower the community to come together, really to make, you know, greater feelings and experience of safety locally. So that's the idea behind partnership. So it's not all, I suppose, down. It's not a whole reliance on Garda Síochána really for community safety. And I suppose we're embedding the local community safety partnership, and hopefully as it gets up and running, you know, we'll be able to work together to improve community safety.
And speaking in terms of embedding processes, you also acknowledged in your own submission to the safety partnership that The new guard, the structure is embedding in as well. You have a responsibility for the Donegal North engagement area. Your colleague, Superintendent Karen Duffy, has responsibility for South Donegal. There's been a lot of discussion over the past number of years about, will Donegal be standalone? Will Donegal be lumped in with Sligo and Leitrim? And then when we saw Milford no longer be a district office per se, what impact was that going to have? And there's been a lot of questions. And one of your jobs really is going to be to see that transition in the Garda model and to make it work across Donegal. It is, you acknowledge the work in progress, but all in all, you believe it's going well.
Well, I suppose we're doing the best we can with it. And like I said, we're still trying to work on it. I'm in place since January, Donal, and it is my intention to set up a hub in Buncrana, a community hub, which would be modelled on the old district there. And there is an inspector there, inspector in charge of the hub. And similarly with Milford district as well, we'll have an inspector in charge of the local hub there. And obviously Letterkenny and Lifford would be included in that. The Lifford area as well has a local hub as well. So we're still working on it. It's a work in progress, but we certainly are very committed to it on Garda Síochána. And, you know, there's four superintendents across the division. And, of course, we're working under Chief Superintendent Sheridan, and we're very committed to make it work. So hopefully it will. And I suppose the collaboration with the Community Safety Partnership, who have contributed to our service plan, you know, it will be important too.
And finally, in terms of collaboration, you also referenced the fact that collaboration with the PSNI is ongoing and is increasing in many ways. And you were quite upbeat about the level of cooperation there is now between the PSNI and An Garda Síochána, particularly along the Donegal, Derry, Tyrone, Fermanagh border.
Yeah, absolutely, Donal. It's really, really important. Like a lot of the, you know, the issues, they straddle the border, you know, crime, it doesn't recognise the border. So it was important. We felt that we needed to, I suppose, reinvigorate our relationship with local management in Northern Ireland, in the PSNI. And they have been very forthcoming. And now we meet regularly at every level, really, and certainly operational meetings. And it's just sharing information and working together. And even on the ground, when there is an issue, if something crosses the border, there's a very, very quick response on both sides. And where we have events, you know, that are important or that are relevant to the border areas too, we tend to work together as well to put in the correct police and response.
Superintendent Siobhan Monaghan, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning.
Thanks, Donald. Good morning.
I wanted to read you a quick line from a BBC story that gave me pause for thought when I read it. More than 500 women are advertised for sex daily on pimping websites in Northern Ireland, with campaigners warning many are organised, coerced and controlled. The women are advertised as independent escorts, offering an extensive list of sex acts and services. However, the reality is much different, according to experts. Now, one of those experts is Ruth Breslin, who is director of the Sexual Exploitation Research and Policy Institute. And I'm delighted to say that Ruth joins us on Zoom this morning. Ruth, a very good morning to you.
Morning, Donal. Thank you for having me here.
It's our pleasure. Ruth, I look at a figure like that and I'm taken aback at the sheer scale of the number and the sheer openness with which it's advertised. You, I suspect, are not as surprised as I am.
No, I'm not surprised at all. These websites are websites that we've been monitoring over quite a number of years now to try and understand. I suppose it gives us an insight into what's happening in the sex trade in Ireland. And I suppose that's the first thing to say. People don't realise necessarily that we have quite an active sex trade in Ireland. You know, that prostitution is happening and that, of course, in some cases, women are being trafficked into prostitution in Ireland. But absolutely, that is happening. And I think also I meet a lot of people who assume that this content is on the dark web. You know, it's difficult to find, you really have to go looking for it. But in fact, all of these sites, including the four sites that are the subject of the inquiry in Northern Ireland, some of which are also operating in down south, they can just be found on the open web in a couple of clicks.
And it's there's an anomaly in the system, it seems, because whereas selling it's a criminal offence to pay for sex, either directly or indirectly. But selling sexual services is not illegal, and that gives those websites an out.
Yes, I suppose we have, if you look at the legislation we have in the Republic of Ireland, which we brought in 2017, and they did a similar model in Northern Ireland in 2015. And I suppose in recognition of the very vulnerable situation for people who sell sex in the majority of cases, it was decided that those women should no longer be considered criminals. They were decriminalized, but it was decided to criminalize those who purchase sex because, after all, that's kind of what drives this market. The demand for purchase of sex drives the market. And it was Ireland and Northern Ireland, I suppose, standing up and saying, you know what, we've decided we don't think it's acceptable to purchase sexual access to someone else's body, especially when that person is more vulnerable than you. But what these websites essentially are doing is they claim to be advertising time and companionship only. And yet that disclaimer is added under a huge list of 15 to 20 sex acts that these women provide. So, I mean, they're just using that disclaimer as a way out. In the Republic of Ireland, it is actually illegal to advertise prostitution, but that goes back to a time when it was paper, it was print, that the ads were in the back of magazines and newspapers. This has never been tested in the online environment. But of course, at the end of the day, the online environment, these websites really amplify the trade, they promote it, they facilitate it. And that's the subject of the inquiry in Northern Ireland, and we would really like to see a similar kind of inquiry and investigation here down south.
Is there an element here of the law of unintended consequences in that, in the attempt not to criminalise women who find themselves in a situation where perhaps they feel they have no choice but to sell their own bodies, you are unintentionally also decriminalising pimping and the means of advertising them?
I think, yeah, that's important, very important to note that although the women themselves, as kind of, individuals selling sex are decriminalised, we still have quite strong laws on our books around organising prostitution, around running a brothel, around human trafficking, obviously, and also around profiting or, benefiting from the prostitution of another person. So the Gardaí still have a lot of tools in their toolbox to use to address the organised element. And I think that's really important. The Guards are very clear that they don't pursue individual women, some of whom have decided this is, a choice for them to do, although for many women that's not the case. The Gardaí are all about pursuing from a criminal perspective, those who are benefiting, those who are profiting. So we do have those laws, but at the same time, these websites for a range of reasons are allowed to persist. And this is the shop market. This is the shop window of the sex trade. And it is connecting those sex buyers with those women they want to purchase sex to with, but they're all, it's also, I suppose, really benefiting the traffickers, the pimps, the organized crime gangs involved in this trade, because they can hide behind that website. And the way they're doing that is they're advertising women with this kind of illusion of independence, whereas we know that the majority of those women are not independent actors in the trade.
Has there been a test case in the courts yet where a case has been taken specifically against one of these websites on the basis that this website is knowingly selling sexual favors? Not sexual favors, that's the wrong phrase, that these websites are knowingly acting as, and let's say the word, they're effectively acting as online pimps.
Yes, and that's right. And actually, that's precisely it, because the Northern Ireland Inquiry has called itself an inquiry into pimping websites, because that's effectively what these are. I would agree with that terminology. We've never had a test case. Instead, what comes up again and again and again, and is noted by prosecutors and judges in cases all the time. So, in cases of pimping and in cases of very serious cases of human trafficking, it'll note that these websites, or one website in particular, has played a significant role in those cases in facilitating the exploitation of women, in facilitating the trafficking of women. So, one website in particular is named on a regular basis in court cases. And yet, we are still waiting for further action, further deeper consideration to being given to the role that these websites play. And I suppose that's what we're trying to kind of highlight through the evidence we're gathering and the monitoring we're doing, that, action needs to be taken. We can't just sit and watch, let these websites operate and profit handsomely from effectively facilitating trafficking and sexual exploitation.
As you're saying, it's one of the major problems with the internet that so many of the laws were drawn up with language that recognises paper and telegraphy and various other means of communication, be they telephonic or whatever, that in many cases, and it seems this is a prime example, we have laws which basically are lagging far behind technological innovation. And maybe there is a need for an updated, amended law that specifically recognises the online space and its impact.
Yes, I completely agree with you. We find this with so many kind of online harms because another area that we're doing a lot of work on is pornography. And it's the same thing. Our laws are very far behind and we're racing to catch up with technological developments and the way in which technology is essentially facilitating violence, sexual exploitation. That's the particular area of focus in our work. So I do think we need to catch up, but I think that the law can be quite a sharp tool in this area. And it also, as well as, outlawing these kind of activities, I think it also speaks to the kind of normative change, that we can have a conversation with people, in general in the public and explain this is what these websites are doing, this is what we're responsible for. We've already decided it's not okay to buy sex from a vulnerable person. So now let's now address all of the other things around that are facilitating that still happening on our island.
It's certainly a very interesting story. As I say, I was somewhat shocked at the numbers and the openness of it all, and the fact that there hasn't been a test case yet is an interesting one, and hopefully we will see movement on this in the interim. Ruth Breslin, thanks indeed very much indeed for sharing that with us, and it's a thing we'll have to recognise. And presumably you would be looking for legal changes on both sides of the border. This isn't exclusive. We read from the BBC report in north of the border, but this is an all island problem.
Absolutely. That's what we said yesterday when we were up in Stormont. This is an all-island sex trade, so we need an all-island response, no doubt.
Ruth Breslin, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Now, I just got a call which asked, could you get the figures for state debt interest being paid? How much was it at its highest? Now, I can't say specifically how much it was at its highest. I've just done a very quick check and I've got, and I will acknowledge up front, by the way, this is an AI-generated summary that I've got online of the situation. It says Ireland's national debt interest payments managed by the NTMA are facing upward pressure with costs projected to rise as, according to RTE.ie, maturing debt is refinanced at higher rates while the gross debt fell to 209.9 billion by early this year, or approximately 38,460 per person in the state. The cost of servicing the debt remains a significant expenditure, with projections suggesting that servicing the debt could increase to roughly 6 billion euro a year by 2030. And that's based on various commentary, and that's collated by AI coming from RTE and also from the Irish Times. In early 2025, it says interest payments accounted for roughly 3.2% of total exchequer spending. That's just some of the what I've been able to pull offline pretty much immediately. So, the national debt well over 200 billion, and we're talking somewhere in the region of 6 billion a year to service that debt. That's interest plus whatever you're taking off the capital as well. So that's the way it stands. Now, I want to go to speak to a lady who's been a prominent figure in Irish life literally for decades, a former presidential candidate, the founder and voluntary CEO of Chernobyl Children International. And this coming Sunday, April 26th, marks 40 years since the devastating incident at Chernobyl. Eddie Roach, good morning.
Good morning, Donal. And can I say it's a real pleasure to talk to you, because I sometimes feel we forget that your part of the country exists and you don't get enough credit for all the extraordinary work that you do. And in relation to our tragedy, in relation to the Donegal response to the crisis of Chernobyl, they have been second to none. Like all around the Inishowen, Foyle Peninsula, all over Donegal, Killybegs, the town of Donegal itself. But you opened your hearts and your homes to the child victims of Chernobyl. And I know a lot of your listeners, Donal, won't even have a personal memory of 1986 because they probably weren't even born then. And I think it is important that we kind of ground it, in the chat to say, like, what actually was it? Because we have to maybe learn something from it. Because for me, I sometimes think that it has become like a symbol, like, a potent, enduring metaphor for catastrophe. And like, in a sense, that's a cautionary tale that we need to take heed today, making sure that it never happens again. Because like, it was, we're looking at a world that is full of chaos, terrible wars breaking out more and more all the time. And it's easy for us to kind of feel paralysed by it. But the war of Chernobyl was an invisible war where you couldn't see the enemy. Like it didn't, it crossed boundaries. You didn't need an entry or an exit visa. Like radioactivity by its nature is invisible and it permeates every part of life, and it's locked in the DNA, it's locked in the genetics, and that caused huge problems for people living in that stricken region of Belarus, northern Ukraine and western Russia. And, like, you know, something we need to remember also is that this year kind of marks, I suppose, you know, like in Ireland, it just doesn't signal a distant tragedy in 1986, but it actually sparked a four-decade-long love affair of compassion, resilience and radical kindness. You know, and like what we're trying to say about the 40th is Chernobyl is forever, because of the fact that it's, you know, it's like a radioactive footprint really is embedded in the land, the water, the air, and particularly it's now done crossing generations.
26,500 children have come to Ireland over the course of that 40 years. It's a huge amount, and many of them, as you said, have come to Donegal. How important is it? As you've said, it's intergenerational. The impact of what happened on April 26th, 1986 still very much reverberates back to this day. Some people will know of Chernobyl, those who are younger, they'll know because of the miniseries that was on HBO and Sky, which was a very stark miniseries, and you, as I believe, were a consultant on that series. For others,
I was.
Talk to us about that first.
Sure. Can I just say about the HBO series, because Jessie Buckley was a dream, and that was before she was as famous as she is now, but like she was a dream to work with, and actually so were the entire group of people that were, you know, from the writer of the series, you know, to the directors and everything. They were terrific. They're actually showing the series as we speak. Again, it's being repeated. So for those that didn't see it before, they should check it out again. But, you know, Donald, one of the things that I'd like to kind of say is about us as an island, because people ask me internationally a lot, well, why did Ireland, a small island on the edge of the Atlantic, become one of the primary lifelines for the victims? And, you know, sometimes I wonder, is it because our own history is etched with huge stories of real displacement and hunger too, and that we recognise other victims because we have been that victim, and it's like a deep-seated echo within all of us. And you know, really, Donal, as an island, Ireland has spoken with the moral authority of a nation that really refused to turn away, and our spirit remains unbowed despite the geopolitical chaos. And I'd like to reassure your listeners that despite the awfulness of COVID that we had for a couple of years, and now we have the awfulness of the horrendous war and invasion assault into Ukraine. Like, we are unbowed by that. We continue to do all of our life-saving work, delivering trucks of aid. We carry out our hospice program. We perform life-saving surgeries. And Donald, would you believe, as I am talking to you on this radio this morning, we have a team of international cardiac surgeons performing life-saving surgeries on babies on the front line of humanitarianism in Ukraine, on babies who have a condition called Chernobyl heart, caused by exposure from the poor mother through the food chain and the water, called that because of the radiation damage. And it's a condition that they cannot live with, but that they will die with without surgical intervention. And our doctors have taken the risk of going out into a war zone because they know that these children are depending on them for their lives to be saved. And they'll be there for the next 2 weeks doing that very task of just saying, you know, we're all part of the same human family. You know, and we'd say in Irish is our Ská Chéile, a Varan Nadina, you know, that we all live in the shadow of each other. And, you know, Ireland has not been found wanting, because I think we recognise that, you know, we've had tragedy ourselves, and we recognise the longevity of this problem, that Chernobyl really is forever, and particularly since the outbreak of the war. I mean, I can't believe this.
And what impact is the war having on the work that's being done, particularly in terms of the medical work? I mean, are doctors being hampered in getting in and out?
Huge. Can I just say, first of all, the fact that the invasion came through the world's most toxic environment, the Chernobyl nuclear exclusion zone. Now, that has never happened in the history of the nuclear age. They've always been off limits because every single person in the world knows that it could have catastrophic potential, but not in this case. And it has changed the nature of modern warfare as a result. So this has a much bigger implication than just for Ukraine. This is like a global issue. When they came and did loads of destruction around the Chernobyl plant, and then they sent a big drone attack over the Chernobyl reactor and caused a huge hole in the sarcophagus, which is there to protect us from the remaining radioactivity. That is like a shock to the system. They have awakened a sleeping giant back in 2022. So this really brings it right back to bear that we cannot ignore Ukraine, and we ignore it at our peril if we do. But Ireland was a first responding country, and I think it is so important, Donal, when we're chatting about this, that we actually, I suppose, take the opportunity to remember what happened, to commemorate it, but to also reflect that the people of Ireland stood up with one voice for 4 decades. I mean, that's an extraordinary outpouring of humanity, because this island responded with the impulses of its heart. And that is so powerful. And many of our volunteers are being recognised this week at Áras an Uachtaráin. On Friday, President Connolly is inviting a group representative of every county in Ireland, coming from Donegal as well, to actually just say, while we remember, commemorate, we will also give gratitude to the wonderful, sterling human beings. Because we're, we're a voluntary organisation.
Eddie Roach, I am really sorry I have to interrupt, but time has beaten us.
Sure.
This is not history. This is a living thing. It's an ongoing thing. It's an ongoing story. And we wish all those volunteers going to the Áras well later this week. We wish you all the best as well. And obviously we wish all the best to those doctors and medical professionals who are giving of their time and taking a risk in going there to do the work they're doing. But for now, Eddie Roach, thank you very much indeed. Just want to bring you a question we received regarding the HSE and an answer that we received from them with regards to a St. Joseph's Hospital. Caller says, could we get clarification on the use of agency staff? I would like to bring it to your attention about the current situation in the community hospital. It's been reported recently about empty beds in the hospital. The HSE have blamed it on lack of staff. They say they're recruiting. They are, in fact, not recruiting. They're bringing in specified contract jobs to cover staff who are long-term sick or on maternity leave, etc. There's only been a few permanent jobs offered. The hospital is full of agency staff every day, and though some are good at their jobs, sadly, that's not always the case. It's putting immense pressure on the current staff to cover not only their own jobs, but to make up for the failings as a result of agency workers being employed. As a result, staff are overworked and going off sick. That's causing even more pressure on the wards. With the fortune they're spending on agency, they could bring much more needed permanent staff into the hospital. That's a comment that came in from a listener. Now, we got a response from the HSE, and the response is as follows. The HSE is committed to comprehensive recruitment and resourcing programmes that include targeted recruitment campaigns, enhanced retention strategies informed by service development and the global market. As part of the HSE's overarching resourcing approach, whereby direct employment does not meet the needs of service delivery requirements, agency staff are utilised. This can be for a variety of reasons, including absence relating to various leave, including maternity, sick leave, etc. The HSE Human Resource Department is actively recruiting to fill posts. Panels are in place from which approved vacancies will be filled as they arise. We also continue to have rolling campaigns across our services and work closely with colleagues in older persons services in order to ensure that recruitment plans are fulfilled. The hospital remains committed, the HSE says, to progressing recruitment as quickly as possible, and to support the full utilisation of bed capacity. That's the response we've had from the HSE. Now, there was, you may well be aware, a gorse fire yesterday, the first major gorse fire I've come across of the year. It happened on Knocky Brin Hill at the mountain top in Letterkenny, and I'm joined on the line by Sharon. Sharon, good morning.
Good morning, Donal. Good morning.
Sharon, you live quite close to where that fire was. I'm sure that must have been a rather frightening experience last night.
It was, Donal. Myself and there is 6 other houses along with us. We live up a lane called Heather View, which is connected to the Red Road, which is onto Knocky Brin, where the fire started. It was very frightening, Donald, to see such close proximity of a wildfire near our home that we were worried about maybe having to evacuate our homes here, all our neighbours, you know.
Now, thankfully, it didn't come to that.
Thank God it didn't, Donal. Great service by the fire brigade. There was two fire brigades landed and their backup truck and a team of fire brigade men went up, the firefighters went up the hill there last night just after 8 o'clock and started to put the fire out. But for a while now, it was very, very frightening. And, you know, there's electricity poles very close to the proximity of where the fire was. And so you have that fear that a pole's going to go on fire as well, you know. So it just was frightening for all of us, you know. And we have a couple of our neighbours have wee animals as well, wee dogs. And, you know, it was frightening for us all, to be honest.
Did you get much sleep last night?
No. No, I didn't, Donal, because the fire brigade left just after 10:30 last night. So myself and a neighbour up the hill here, we were actually talking and we saw them leaving and we presumed that the fire was out. But to be honest, you don't get much sleep because you're worried with the wind, because I put my little dog out to the toilet just after midnight and it was still, you could smell the smoke horrendously, and it was down in the air, like it was kind of, the house felt kind of all smoked round, and you just had that fear with the wind picking up that, you know, maybe they missed a little bit, or, you know, yourself in the undergrowth, it could have just started up again. So very little sleep last night, to be honest.
And how far away is your house from the seat of the fire? How close would the flames have actually got?
The flames, I would say we were about 800 yards away. 500 to 800 yards away. My neighbour were closer. Joe and Maggie lived just directly behind us. And at one stage, it looked as if the fire was going over that way to the right, to their house, you know. But I've seen, actually, a friend of mine sent me a picture that had been put up on your post. And it shows my house very clearly. So it just shows you, you know, you don't think, I'm living here 22 years. And never, ever have I seen this hill go on fire. And also, I was talking to Gabrielle last night, my neighbour, who lives directly next door to me. And Gabrielle said that she's here over 40 years and has never seen a fire on that hill. So it was a very frightening experience for everybody, you know, in the area.
Absolutely. Sharon, we are obviously delighted that you and your family and all your neighbours are safe. That's first and foremost. Obviously delighted your property is safe as well and the fire didn't actually reach there. Hopefully you'll get a better night's sleep tonight. And as you said, first and foremost, fair play to the fire brigade and the firefighters who came out and dealt with it, because it seemed they did their job.
Exactly.
They did it well, and everyone is safe and well after it. And it's also a salutary lesson to all of us that when these orange gorse fire warnings come out, that we need to heed them, because, I mean, it is a real risk, and particularly in the current conditions. It's dry, it's windy, and you're going to have that undergrowth that could be ripe for starting a gorse fire. So we all need to be really, really careful about what we're doing and how we're acting to try and minimise the risk of fires like this starting. And hopefully this will be the only gorse fire we have to contend with in the coming months.
I hope so, Donal. I hope so, because it is a frightening experience for everybody. And, you know, as I say, thanks again to the firefighters, to the fire brigades that came. And there was actually a tractor came with a large tankard of water as well, just after the two fire brigades. So thank you to that gentleman as well. You know, it was great response to them to go so quickly and put it out efficiently as well.
Yeah.
So, thanks.
Excellent.
The services we have here, we're lucky.
Okay. Well, thank you very much indeed, Sharon. And glad that everything turned out okay. Thank you indeed. That's Sharon there speaking to us with regards
thank
to that
you,
fire.
Thank you, Donal.
Thank you. That fire at Knocky Brin last night. The pictures are up on the Highland Radio website. a frightening experience, no doubt, for Sharon and for her neighbours. Just want to mention, by the way, the Glenelly Colts under 16 girls are on their way to a really important final. Fair play to them for qualifying. But as is always the case, when you're going for something like that, it costs money. So there is a fundraiser taking place on Saturday to support the girls. It's taking place at the Glenelly Colts clubhouse. You can meet the team, get some photographs. There's a cup of tea and some lovely bakes available as well, with great company. And all donations are accepted. You can also use a Revolut tag on their Facebook page if you wish to do so. All proceeds go toward helping the team get to the final, and the best of luck to them. Now, I want to talk about the plans for a new transport hub in Letterkenny, because as we've said a couple of times over the course of the past few days, there is a long-term plan to develop a transport hub stroke bus station at the old bacon factory in Letterkenny and have a site that fronts onto both Port Road and Pierce Road. The suggestion has also been made that there needs to be a new look at the old Oatfield site and to use that as the bus depot. It was suggested by a caller earlier this week, and we're joined on the line this morning by Anthony, who has the same belief. Anthony, good morning.
Good morning, Dolo. How are you?
Very well indeed. Anthony, you believe that the bacon factory will just add to traffic problems in Letterkenny and that the Oatfield site is the way to go?
Yeah, I think it definitely will, Dolo. I'm taxiing here in Letterkenny and I'm on the ground every day. And I think the bacon factory site will definitely add problems between the Pierce Road and the Port Road, and the traffic there in the mornings and the traffic in the evenings. And I think that I can't understand why maybe the council haven't looked at the Oatfield site and the planners have looked at it, you know, because to me it's a no-brainer, you know, because it's it wouldn't be really affecting the traffic in any way. You know, you come in there to that, it's a massive big yard, you know. I worked in Oatfield for years and I walked the yard every day and I would inside out. And I mean, all the buses that you have coming in, you, I mean, you have a lot of buses coming in there every day, right? You know, and it's a real bottleneck there in front of Murphy Sports there and that now at the minute, you know. And taxis can't get in, taxis can't get out. And I mean, all them buses that's coming in, John McGinley, Fida O'Donnell, Mangans, Patrick Gallagher, TFA, I mean, them buses are all from the west of the county. And, you know, for themselves and for the traffic in Letterkenny, when they would come in there, into that Oatfield site, drop off their passengers up the hill, their way up the mountain top, back down home, you know, wouldn't be interfering. But if they have to come in there, try and get in that traffic over the Pierce Road, into the bacon factory site, come back out then up Doherty's Lane, back out then in front of where Glenini was there, back into the traffic and the roundabout. Sure, I mean, it's going to be a disaster.
Can I read you, I just want to read you a clip from the Letterkenny 2040 page, which is the forward-looking plan that includes the first drafts of potential plans for the what they're calling a transport hub. Now, what they have found following a consultation is a combination of sites located between Port Road and Pierce Road would be most attractive for a transport hub. Frontage around Pierce Road offers potential for gateway and public realm. A regional bus service could operate via access it via Port Road. So the idea would be, if you're coming in from Inishowen, from that direction past the ATU, that you would actually access the site from the Port Road. You would leave it via the Pierce Road, and the town bus service would operate along a curbside at the Pierce Road with a dedicated interchange. And that would mean then that the town bus wouldn't be interfering with the regional buses coming into the actual transport hub. Now, they have a rather large building in place with presumably a lot of ancillary the things like a coffee shop and a cafe and all that. So that's what they would be planning. And I would find myself wondering, is the Oatfield site big enough for that, particularly when you bear in mind that the council is looking at developing in excess of 200 social homes behind and to the side of the fire station there? So that's going to come down quite a bit into the Oatfield space, as it were.
Yeah, well, I would say the council don't know what size it is, because I would say they never looked at it. I can't understand why. But the many buses is coming on there every day, and you're saying if them buses are coming out onto the Pierce Road, right, and coming back into that roundabout there at Tesco, sure, I mean, it's going to be a real bottleneck. And, you know, if you look at the people that's using the buses, you know, and the access, the quick access away, you know, the ATU, you know, they have a taxi rank beside it, shopping centre, bus airing, all the hospitals, you know, people going for appointments to the hospitals. You know, I just think that the Oatfield site is definitely the site for it.
And you see, and you believe the Oatfield site is big enough for a fully fledged transport hub. Now, there have been some suggestions that develop the bacon factory. Now, the reality is the bacon factory, if that could be developed within 5 to 6 years, that would be very quick. And I suspect it's going to take longer than 5 or 6 years before they can develop a transport hub fully at the bacon factory. I think it's going to take a little bit more even than 5 or 6 years. But even in the interim, put something at the old Oatfield site as a stopgap measure, because at the moment, what we have at the Murphy Sports, Mr. Chippy area there, it's effectively a bus stop. And that's all it is, really. There are no facilities. There's certainly no toilets. There's no cafe. There's no space for a cup of coffee. There isn't even somewhere for a person to sit. I mean, which is the reality, unless you sit on the wall, as people do every day. But you have a situation at the moment where buses are stopping at that bus stop, and it's causing a tailback anyway, heading right back to the roundabout, because, you know, people can't get past the buses if there's 3 or 4 stops, particularly in the early evening or in the early morning. So there definitely needs to be something. And in the interim, they're looking at putting a better shelter there. But you do believe the transport hub is the long-term ideal?
Definitely. I mean, the ground and all, you know, it's made at that Oatfield site. I mean, because the factory was there, that ground's there for hundreds of years. And, you know, it'll be a lot a quicker fix and a far easier site to get ready for it. A transport hub, you know.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're on about building a bigger bus shelter there where, at the minute, where the buses are pulling in.
Yeah.
So when them buses are pulling in there, and health and safety, it's dangerous, you know, because there are people getting off and running here and there, and then the people coming out in front of Murphy Sports, they can't get out of that entrance, and then you can't go back the other way because it's one way.
Yeah, and that is one of the biggest taxi ranks in that area as well. I absolutely appreciate that.
It is,
totally, yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, if you have people coming in over at the bacon factory and, you know, the taxis are all sitting over in the taxi rank at St. Oatfield, well, these people are going to be over standing about the bacon factory and no lift, or, you know.
Well, presumably, if they're going to develop a transport hub at the bacon factory, they're going to have to look at putting a full taxi rank in there as well. And actually, there would have to be a huge development. It's not just going to be just build a bus stop with no ancillary services. I mean, if they're going to do it, they're going to have to do it right.
Yeah, and it'll take a lot more money for that bacon factory site, you know. And I'm sure that they could do the Oatfield one a lot cheaper and use some of the money for something else, you know.
Yeah. Well,
I think it's going to cause more grief with traffic, because, I mean, we're trying to get away from that Tesco roundabout. We're trying to, you know, spread the town out, you know. But once you start to go in around there with big coaches, you know, sure. I mean, I don't know if the planners ever be out on the ground or, you know, if they're working in an office, you know what I mean? No disrespect to them, but you need to be out on the ground to see this. If they spend a taxi...
But surely anything coming from the Oatfield side is still going to have to go on to the station roundabout, because if you're taking traffic toward Dublin, or you're taking traffic up toward Inishowen, you're taking traffic toward Lifford, Strabane, Ballybofey, Stranorder, Donegal Town, wherever, all of that's still going to have to go from Oatfield. Now, unless you take it out to the Ballyrain school there and the roundabout at Ballyrain.
You can go the new link road and out Ballyrain school.
Yeah.
I mean, I know all them roads are all...
And the problem there is they're cutting lanes off those roads right, left and centre. I mean, are they going to be ready to have more buses thrown at them? Because you now have a situation, you know, with those roads where you actually don't have... You have the actual... It was a two-lane. It looks like it's going to become just one lane now going to that roundabout, with all cars turning both left and right at Ballyrain roundabout going the same way. It's an interesting one.
That's,
I have to say, Shannon did.
Full stop,
I absolutely agree with you there, Anthony. I mean, like most people who live in Letterkenny, I'm in that area several times a week. I
know you are. Yeah.
Yeah. We
until
have
we get this
we did
bridge
put a,
until
yeah.
we get a ring road. I don't know.
Well,
you know, it's not getting any better. It's getting
I mean, if we're
in taxi rank now and we're picking up somebody local around Letterkenny and we're taking them somewhere local.
Yeah.
Say you're picking them up over at, I would say, the Pierce Road somewhere, right, and you're taking them to Ballymacoolwood or something.
Yeah.
From we leave the rank now, do we pick the person up and drop them off and get back to the rank? We're an hour. You're 1 hour away. I mean, we're not making money.
Yeah.
You know, that's the way it's gone too, as well. You know, I mean, we're running there, we're just surviving. You know, every day in the taxis because we can't get anywhere. You know, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
And then these the cycle lanes. I'm not against them. And these big wide footpaths, sir. I mean, up around that hospital and around Optum and there, sure, it's a disaster.
Shannon did put a poll up on the website and you know, just ask people for their own opinions. And I'm going to give you some of the comments that we've got in from people. Charlie says, it won't happen for some time yet. As stated yesterday, it's in the pipeline. That pipeline must be blocked. Ivan says the old Oatfield site would be the perfect spot. Trish, old Oatfield site would be a great location, close to where the buses come in now. The Bacon Factory site still has too many busy roads for our elderly to cross to get to the bus. Billy says, I've been saying for years the old Oatfield site. James points out the ATU campus has only a single lane for a bus drop-off but no parking for events like Careers Days, which is a massive part of attracting future students. They should be a straight drive-through for all coaches, one point entry, one point exit, and for God's sake, can someone put a sign up on the roundabout deterring cars from parking on it and keep the yellow boxes clear? Jason says the old Oatfield site, Audrey Oatfield site, near to lots of amenities. Annabelle Oatfield site would be great. Patricia, behind Lanealy House, big area there. That is the Bacon Factory site, effectively, Patricia. Kira, I've been saying for years the old Oatfield site or out where the tourist office is could have a tanky rank out there or a shuttle bus to take people into town. The current situation at Mr. Chippy isn't fit for purpose. I think everyone's going to agree with that one, Kira, in terms of the current situation. Out by the old tourist office, an interesting idea, maybe just a touch too far out, particularly for older people. Catherine Oatfield, Charlie, the council own the old Bacon Factory site, so why not there? And Bill, are there not question marks over the ownership of the old Bacon Factory, or did the council buy it? Now, I know there was an old civil defence office there many, many years ago at the Bacon Factory site, so I'm not 100% sure of the ownership. I can't speak to that. But certainly it's an ongoing situation and more and more people commenting. And one person says, actually, and this is an interesting one, the amount of people that have stopped coming into Letterkenny because of the traffic is unreal. And I can certainly say there are times I wouldn't care to venture. I live in the Glencar area, and there are times I wouldn't be particularly pushed about leaving Glencar to drive in toward the town, to be honest, because of the traffic situation.
Well,
so I can understand that.
Oh, it's desperate. Mm.
Yeah.
In the mornings there in the evenings, sure, the evening's disaster altogether. They're from 4 o'clock to half six there, you know.
Yeah.
Even the mornings from 8 till 10, sure, it's just no go, you know.
It's going to be an ongoing discussion, Anthony, and we look forward to seeing what they come up with.
Yeah.
But hopefully we'll get some sort of clarity as to what the council's plans are in the not-too-distant future. But, Anthony, for the moment, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks for having me on, Donal. Thank
Absolutely
you for
pleasure.
Having me.
It's a pleasure, and we'll have to keep an eye on the situation as time goes on. Time for our Wellness Wednesday spot, and delighted to welcome onto the show this morning Lorraine Smith, who is a cancer survivor and has agreed to join us to discuss her story. Lorraine, good morning.
Hi, Donald. How are you?
Very well indeed. Lorraine, 2020, 2021, for a lot of us, those years bring up images of COVID and all that went with it. For you, it brings up the biggest change you've had to your health and your circumstances in your life so far.
Yeah, really. It was 2020, actually, in May 2020, I was fit and healthy. I was doing couch to 5K running. I was kayaking, and I was out on the kayak one day. And when I got out, I thought, God, I must have pushed myself a bit too much because a big lump had popped up on my breast. And I said, it must be a cyst because it was the size of an egg. So normally you hear people saying, oh, I found a lump. It was the size of a pea and it was cancer. So I said, I better get it checked out. And I went to the triple negative. I went to the clinic in St. James's and the assessment clinic. And they, 3 weeks later, told me I had triple negative breast cancer, stage 3, which was aggressive. It's an aggressive cancer. And so I was straight away into treatment. So I had chemotherapy, radiotherapy, I had a mastectomy, and I had, it turned out I had two lumps, and then I had cancer in my lymph nodes under my arm as well. So they removed my lymph nodes when they did the treatment. So I was, I kind of had a very positive outlook on it. When they told me I had cancer, I didn't panic or anything. I said, okay, so what's the plan? So I just kind of kept really kind of busy. I continued working because I loved the job I was doing. I'm a digital manager in the HSE. So I continued working while I had the cancer, and it was during COVID, and I was working on the COVID patient monitoring app, which is really important. So I said, I'm not going to stop this during COVID. So basically I continued on, and they told me in the, say, the February of the next year that they had got everything out, and that I was just then going to, you have to wait for 5 years before you get the all clear. But when I was finished all the treatment, I realized that there was something called lymphedema. It wasn't really on my radar, but another woman actually emailed me and said to me, Lorraine, do you know about lymphedema? And I said, no. And she said, you know, you need to do all these exercises and nutrition and stuff like that, you know, to prevent lymphedema. And I said, it wasn't really on my radar, but I said, I'll look it up. And I'm kind of the type of person that goes off and researches everything. So I researched about lymphedema, and I discovered that there's a track through your system, your lymph nodes. It goes right the way through your body, and that pushes around this lymph fluid around your body. And I had my complete clearance of lymph nodes on my left arm. So when they take out the lymph nodes, there's nowhere for the lymph fluid to go. So to prevent you developing lymphedema, you have to do these exercises. So I got a few exercises, and I thought, well, this is grand. Maybe I'll have to do this for 3 or 4 weeks. But it turns out that you don't. You have to continue doing it for the rest of your life, because the lymphedema could develop. Like this woman had said, it developed a year after she had her mastectomy, and it can develop at any time.
And the characteristic of lymphedema, just as I understand it, and I have a very, very vague knowledge of it, but my understanding of lymphedema is it leads to swelling, that you can get some very severe swelling around limbs, and you can sometimes see people with sort of huge swelling on their legs or whatever, and that very often can be characteristic of lymphedema, and that's what you're trying to prevent.
That's exactly what we're trying to prevent. So a lot of places you'd get it, like some people, if they get their lymph nodes removed in their head and neck, you could see people with big swelling there, or their arms and the breast. And you can see, like, your arm doesn't just swell. It swells out like three times the size of what normally would be. It's really extreme. And you can get it in your legs as well. And, like, there's actually no cure for it, like, right? So all you can have is treatment after, to kind of, you know, just treatment regularly to help it. But there is no actual cure for it. So prevention is better than cure.
Yeah.
So basically what I did then, because I worked in the HSE and I worked in digital technology, I investigated what they had on the HSE learning tool, HSE Land. And then I connected with the head of the project manager for Kay Morris, the project manager for lymphedema in the HSE. And I said to her, do you know, I was thinking, you know, it would be a very good idea to do an app to help people to do their exercises. I said, I'm here working away and I forget to do them, and before you know it, the day is done and I don't have them done. And she said, do you know, we were thinking the same thing. So the two of us got together and we did a business plan, and we applied for an innovation grant with the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform. Mm. And we were lucky enough to get an innovation grant.
You got money from DEEPR?
We did, yeah, I know.
Oh, very few people can say that.
It's not the first time that I've got money from DEEPR either. So, like, I think I must be blessed. I think it's St. Anthony sitting up there every time looking in my office. So, yeah, no, I got money from DEEPR. Yeah, the Innovation Fund, yeah. And so that's how it started. So then the HSE then gave us some funding as well. And basically we had this app. And what it does is three times a day, it has all the information about lymphedema that you'd ever need, like, right? And then it has all the information about how to keep your skincare and what to do to prevent lymphedema. And then it has exercises on it. So the app actually tells me, it's on my phone, and every day it'll tell me at 8 o'clock, have you done your exercises? Yeah. Then it tells me at 1 o'clock, and then it tells me at 6 o'clock. So I set it at those times. That's the times when I eat. So I set it for me so that I thought this would be a good idea. This is when I stop working and I can do a few exercises. And at the end of the day, it's gamified, meaning when at the end of the day, when you've done your three exercises, you get like graffiti comes down. So it makes you feel better, like, you know. But there's also stuff on it about mental health and, you know, about surveillance. And, you know, it tells you like to check things like, is your clothes getting tighter and stuff like that. And so it's really, really good. And the really good part about it as well is it was devised by patients. Like, so we had a patient advocacy group together with clinicians. And the videos, there's actually videos within the app that shows you how to do the exercises. And the videos, in the videos, are real patients. So you have real patients doing the exercises, and you have real clinicians. So the clinicians were from Limerick and Cork and Dublin, and the patients were from different parts of the country as well, Wexford. And so, yeah, it's really good because it's real, because you can actually see the people and they just look normal. They're not actors or anything like this. So it's really, really good. And so it's really, it's for people who haven't developed lymphedema yet. So to prevent the VAP. And the reason why I'm speaking to people about it now at the moment is because it's been on trial for a year in Limerick. And we are now putting it out there that it's self-service.
Yeah.
So if you go into the app store now, you can actually download this app. So what it'll do is there's three different programs. There's the head and neck, there's the lower body and the leg, and there's the arm and breast. And you choose whichever program suits you. And then that brings you through, and it brings you to your exercise plan and your daily routines and stuff like that. And it's free. So you just go into the app store as normal and you type in HSE and then Lymph, L-Y-M-P-H, Active. So it's called Lymph Active. And it's free. And it's a really good tool. So anybody who's had their lymph nodes removed after cancer can download this app. The other thing about it was, as we were going along developing the app and doing the research and stuff, we were coming upon lots of women and people who, it's not only for women, it's for men and women, but we were coming across lots of people that had developed lymphedema already. 1,500 cancer survivors every year develop lymphedema. Yeah. So we had come across a lot of them, and they were saying, well, there's nothing for us. Can you do something for us? So we went back and tried to get more money. So we have in the process at the moment, we have that in the future, there will be on the app that you can go to. There'll be two divides. There'll be preventative and the management.
Control.
So there'll be two different parts of it. So basically, it's for anybody who's had their lymph nodes removed, and they can just go into the app store, download it, and work away on it. Like, and it's really brilliant. And I'm trying to get people, I'm working with the Cancer Society and working with radiologists across the country to try and get a link in to people so that they can find this out, because it's not really highly publicised. So that's what I'm trying to do at the moment.
It's a wonderful story, Lorraine, and fair play to you and to Kay and to others for putting in the work that's got this done. And it must be great from your own point of view to be actually using an app on a daily basis to prevent something from happening that you played an absolute key role in creating. We'll certainly pass on the details to anyone that contacts us that wants to get the details, and all the best with it, Lorraine. It's a wonderful story to hear, and thanks very much indeed for sharing it with us this morning.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on.
It's been an absolute pleasure. That's Lorraine there. And Lymph Active is the name of the program. And if you've had your lymph nodes removed for whatever reason, this is the program you can use to prevent lymphedema. You can actually start this. You don't need a referral from a GP. You don't need any medical advice before taking it. It's dedicated exercises, and it'll really help you maybe steer clear of lymphedema. And if it does happen, then obviously we're looking at management and control provisions in the future as well. But for the moment, Lorraine, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
I always love it when we get musicians in the studio. And today we have a number of musicians because we're speaking about a really important festival that's coming up over the weekend. I am joined in studio by Roisin McGrory, who's a committee member of the Phil and the Hinsha, also by Paul Harrigan, committee member, by Deirdre McGrory, who is a singer and whistle player, Jack Houston, who's a fiddle player, and Roisin also plays fiddle, and Paul plays piano, accordion, and about 187 other instruments as well. Phil and the Hinsha, it's taking place this weekend. It's organised by the Inishowen Trad Project, and it's to celebrate the legacy of a really, really important musician in this county. And I think, Roisin, you're going to outline to us exactly what the background of this festival is.
Yes, thanks very much for having us. Well, Phil and the Hinsha starts now on Friday night, the 25th, and it runs to Sunday, 24th to the 26th. And it's this year's festival is a celebration of the legacy of Dinny McLaughlin, who was a fiddle player and teacher, music teacher, dance teacher, storyteller, composer. He did. He was a kind of a real kind of legacy around Buncrana. So it's celebrating all the elements of his life. So we start off on Friday night with an audience with Alia. That would have been the band that he played with. And then we have different like workshops during the day. We have a poetry and recitation. Dinny was big into writing poetry as well. And then we have a film around 4 o'clock of Dinny's life. And later on that night, we have the Inishowen Trad Orchestra and Choir. Now, that event has sold out, so we've rescheduled it for Sunday at 2 o'clock as well. And we have a singing session just before that at 12 o'clock in the morning with Michael Gallina and Jimmy McFarland. And then, as I said, we have the orchestra performance. And following that, we have dance workshops and then a big session. And we've loads of other session trails over the weekend as well. So there's a lot of events, and hopefully we'll capture all the different elements of Dinny's life.
And there's a lot of important Inishowen musicians and indeed musicians from further afield taking part, the Henry Girls. It's almost inevitable if anything musical is happening in Inishowen, the Henry Girls have to be there. I think there's a law that says that somewhere. You've also got Kieran Tourish, and you have Martin Tourish as well. Now, Martin, obviously, involved with Alton, accordionist and composer as well. And Martin doing some very specific work, getting stuff together for the festival.
Yeah, the Inishowen Trad Orchestra and Choir was formed in 2019, and we've done a few performances and one in the National Concert Hall in January 2023. And actually, Dinny was still alive at the time, and he was there and met the president. And it was just a lovely day for Inishowen, where Martin had selected a lot of the music from the archives, and one of the movements was Dinny's music. So he had arranged that for 130-piece orchestra and choir. So it's a lot of musicians from Inishowen and surrounding areas, Derry, Letterkenny as well. So we're very fortunate to have such a wealth of music there and kind of to be able to celebrate it.
And very often when we're speaking about traditional musicians and festivals in their memory, we're talking about people that died decades and decades and decades ago. The reality is Dinny McLaughlin died in 2024. So all of you would have known him. All of you, I presume, would have played with him at some point over the years. I mean, we aren't celebrating some historical figure from way back when. We're celebrating someone who is still very much alive and still very much known and still very much loved.
And he was a bit of a character as well, so that's one of the elements. There's lots of space over the weekend for people to kind of recount stories. There's lots of stories, and we know there's a lot of poems that Dinny wrote on his travels out there as well. So at the poetry event, we're hoping that maybe people will kind of arrive with some poems that were written. Some of them very humorous, but no, he was a larger-than-life character, a complex character as well. He was a bit of a genius when it came to composing and, you know, everything that he's done with the music and the singing and the dancing and Inishowen.
It's time for some music. Tell us what you're about to perform.
We're going to play a piece Dinny composed. It's called Carrie Keane, which was the gentle rock. It was composed for a christening of a child. So it's a gentle rock, as in rocking the baby.
Okie doke, take it away.
Lishia Salanu, Lishia Sagra,
Absolutely beautiful. That's Roisin, Paul, Deirdre, Jack performing Carrie Queen. That's a slow song that was written by Dinny McLaughlin. Dinny being celebrated at Fin and the Hinche, which is taking place over the weekend, April 24th to 26th in Bunclana. We had hoped to get some reels in as well, but I'm afraid, folks, we have run out of time. But there'll be plenty of reels in Bunclana over the weekend, and you'll get to hear all that and more. This has been The Greg Hughes Show with Donal Kavanagh. Thank you so much to all our guests, to all our listeners. Thanks to Shannon for all of her help, to Caroline for her production and for holding my hand as always. John's up next around the Northwest. For myself, Donal, have a great day.